All right, so we're in 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. We basically got through verse 10 on Wednesday night, but just to kind of recap verses 4 through 10, as we get to this section, we are actually focusing a little bit on what God is doing with His chosen ones. God chose us, and in 1 Peter 1, 3 through 12, He has granted the chosen a wonderful salvation. And then in verses 13 through chapter 2, verse 3, you have our call to action, what we are to do about the fact that God has chosen us. As we think about our wonderful salvation, there are some natural actions that will follow. Then in verse 4, He describes a building that God is constructing. And of course, this building is the church, it's the household of God, it's the temple of God, and it is a building of living stones. And just like the temple would have been a glorious structure that was meant to show the holiness and power of God, we as His people are to live and fit on the foundation in such a way that the world sees something about God when they look at the structure that He is now bringing. And so in verse 9, He goes on a list of descriptions of us, and He says we are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. And do you see what He does with His chosen people? He turns them into proclaimers of His excellency. And so God has chosen us to be a building that proclaims the excellencies of God. And so that kind of wraps up what we discussed Wednesday. Let's go ahead and read verses 11 and 12. As a result of what God is doing, again, this is our, again, a response that we are to have. Carrie, could you read 11 and 12?
Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation.
All right, and so verse 11, beloved, I urge you. This is an application of being God's chosen people. How do we, as a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a people possessed by God, how are we to function in this world? Understanding what God is doing becomes a source of inspiration or a call to, again, act a certain way. And again, He uses the terms aliens and strangers. Again, key words in 1 Peter. From the very beginning of this letter, he is writing those who, again, don't fit in to the world that they are living in because of the fact that they were chosen by God. So they're not going to look like everybody else. They're going to be foreigners, right? They're not going to embrace the same values. They're not going to have the same goals for their life as the Gentiles around them. They're not going to belong. Now, what does He tell them specifically to do in verse 11? Because they are strangers and aliens, because they're foreigners, what are they told to do? Abstain. Abstain from what?
The local customs.
Yeah, the local customs, sure. Are you being
fleshly lusts?
Fleshly lusts. There you go. Okay, I wasn't sure if you had a creative way of describing.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Fleshly lusts.
Got it. Yeah, fleshly lusts. That's right. Because we represent a different home, we are to make decisions that reflect again, as we've seen from time to time, that this world is not our home. Now, how does he say, what sort of intensity of a decision is this? Do you notice what he says those fleshly lusts do towards us? They wage war. And as I read that, you know, that tells me there is a battle that is being fought. You know, I am in the midst of a conflict, and there is a pressure around me again to conform to the fleshly lusts of the world. And what God is saying is I need to be prepared to battle against that pressure and abstain. Now the term, again, wage war, is not a surprise, is a term that describes carnal warfare. And again, you think of like the nature of like first century combat and just how violent it was, how grand it was on some standpoint. But again, it's like we're lining up, we have our shield, we have our sword, we have our helmet. You know, we have our loins girded and our feet shod. You know, God has prepared us to enter into a battle zone, and he uses these terms to describe our spiritual warfare. So again, we can't lose sight of the vivid ways that the Lord chose to describe our spiritual warfare. You know, you could almost think that it's not appropriate. I remember a few years ago, you know, again, like the way the media portrays athletes is sometimes kind of funny. But there was a college guy who just said, "I'm a warrior, and I'm a battler, and you know, I'm going to fight out there." And for some reason, they decided at this occasion to say how insensitive of him to describe himself as a warrior. Which again, you hear those sort of images all the time. But on this particular day, they're like, that is not appropriate. You know, there are young men your age who are actually fighting battles. And that's true. You know, I'm always saying the media is kind of being inconsistent in how they refer to things. But the idea at this particular point in time is you can't describe yourself as being engaged in a conflict that, you know, when you're really just playing the game, right? It's an inappropriate comparison. But when we're talking about a spiritual warfare, it's not inappropriate at all. In fact, the warfare we're engaged in has greater stakes than the physical conflicts that nations find themselves in. And so again, this is an appropriate way to understand when I wake up in the morning and I'm preparing for the day. You know, am I prepared for the war that is being waged against my soul? And I hope I'm prepared. Comments or questions on the battle or thoughts about that?
It's the distinguishing mark between human, man, and animal. An animal can satisfy its lust, its desires. And that's what God designed to do. Mm-hmm. We are set above them. And our battle is against the fleshly lust that we come in contact with, where we live in every day. Our society is trying to blend the two, or have blended the two. There's no longer any battle.
Yeah. And again, when you see the fruit of that, it becomes pressure on us to conform to it. Now, what happens if you have two sides who are at war, but one side doesn't acknowledge it? Who's going to win? You know, obviously the one that's fighting. You know, I think of maybe illustrate it this way. You know, if you're at a stoplight at the front and you're up against a really nice car and maybe kind of a sports car, you decide, you know, I'm going to beat them off the line. And so the race starts and you're racing, but they're not. They still might beat you, but you know, who's going to win the race when only one person is running? You know, and one person is trying. You know, the one trying. You know, and so the again, this is communicating a reality. There is a war being fought against us. And the only way we're going to be able to stand is if we are fighting the battle as God has asked us to fight it and as God has instructed us to fight it. Don't be unaware of the conflict that you are engaged in this very day. Verse 12. So what are they called to do? Abstain from fleshly lust and to do what?
Maintain excellent behavior.
Yeah. Keep your behavior excellent. Excellent. That's kind of an interesting term. Do we use the word excellence often? And we kind of see that word as reserved, right?
Often we don't have an opportunity to use excellence. Yeah.
You don't see it a lot, right? You know, early on, I mean, one of my early sermons, I talked about pursuing excellence. And I think in the sermon, I made a comment about how, don't you want excellence? And afterwards, I'll remember Ben kind of said, you know, what I observe is people don't want excellence. You know, and people are happy with, you know, mediocrity. They're happy with just doing enough to get by. What I observe is people don't want excellence. And as I thought about it, you know, those who really, truly want excellence are probably few and far between. So there aren't a lot of examples. I think you're right. Not a lot of opportunities to actually see especially excellent behavior. But he tells them to keep their behavior excellent. Again, don't just try to be good enough. Don't just try to be a little better than others. Strive for excellent behavior. I want you to notice how often the word behavior is used. Chapter 1, verse 15, he says, "But like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves also in all your behavior." In 1 Peter 2:12, keep your behavior excellent. Chapter 3, verse 1, "In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, that they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives." Verse 2, "As they observe your chaste and respectful behavior." Chapter 3, verse 15 and 16. "But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence, and keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame." And so Peter talks a lot about behavior. Excellent behavior is really the theme of 1 Peter chapter 2, starting in verse 11 and going to the end of chapter 4. And so if you want to just kind of file that away in your mind, as we're studying the meat of Peter, the bulk of Peter, what is being described is what excellent behavior looks like. Interestingly, the word excellent is also translated beautiful. I kind of like that. Keep your behavior beautiful. And, you know, that fits well with exactly what he tells the wives to do in chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. A beautiful, becoming behavior. Now, he says, if they observe your beautiful behavior, what will that cause them to, what will that force them to do?
Bring themselves up to your measure.
Okay. Yeah. That may be.
That's slander.
Yeah. The temptation will be to slander, right? They're going to want to speak down, but what are they going to have to do in the day of visitation instead? Instead of speaking down, what are they going to do? They're going to glorify God. And so, in other words, we live in such a way that when others see our good behavior, they glorify God. Does that remind you of any well-known passage in the Gospels? Let your light shine before men, so that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. And so we find that very idea right here. You know, have an excellent behavior so that when people see your good deeds and observe them, they glorify God in the day of visitation. Now, what do you think the day of visitation is all about?
Coming of the Lord.
Yeah, and that there would be basically two ways of looking at that. And Peter talks a lot about the second coming. And so there's a lot in 1 Peter that would suggest that. So I'm not going to say that it's not, but I want to give at least the other way that this might be looked at. I turn back to Luke chapter 19. Luke chapter 19. This is the only other time where this term, visitation, is used. And so this either refers to the final judgment, or it is a term that refers to an opportunity for salvation. Luke 19, verse 44. We'll start in verse 42. Of course, this is when Jesus is weeping over Jerusalem. He says, if you had known in this day, even you, the things which make for peace, but now they have been hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will throw up a barricade against you and surround you and hem you in on every side. And they will level you to the ground and your children within you. And they will not leave in you one stone upon another because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. And so here, you know, there is a judgment that's going to come on Jerusalem. But previous to that judgment was a time of visitation that they failed to recognize. And so Jesus came. He came, you know, as it says in verse 42, to provide the things that make for peace. He came to bless them. Salvation was in their presence. But they didn't recognize it. So, again, we've talked a lot about how the world sees the living stone and how God sees the living stone. Remember, back in 1 Peter chapter 2, the world rejected God's living stone, while God saw it as choice and precious in His sight. And so it's like here God places a stone right in Jerusalem. And he's like, here it is, here's my plan, here's my blessing to you. But the builders rejected it. You know, God, according to Luke 19, gave them a day of visitation. Here is salvation. Enjoy it. But instead of enjoying it, they recognize it. Now here, again, this may very well just be the final judgment, but it might be the opportunity where a sinner is offered an opportunity to respond to salvation. And so again, the idea is we are living with an evangelistic intent. And maybe the day of visitation is a day where someone's hit rock bottom, you know. And you know, maybe you're in your office and they've had an opportunity to observe your good behavior for perhaps years. And now, you know, their spouse is sick, or the bottom's falling out in some area of their life. Perhaps that is the day that God is visiting them. And maybe instead of slandering you as evildoers, they think about all the example that you have shown for them, and now they're ready to glorify God. And so that's a suggestion. It's probably one or the other, but the day of visitation is either the second coming, or it's a time where one is perhaps ready to respond to the gospel. And our good deeds can play a role in that day. Comments or questions?
Some commentators referred it to when Moses appeared to the people. So in Exodus 3:16, says, go gather the elders of Israel together and save them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt.
So which word is he connecting it to? The word appeared? Or do you know which word?
Yes, this, the day of appearance or the day of visitation.
Yeah.
He knows when we are, he knows when his children are really struggling.
Mm-hmm.
He'll carry you. He'll visit you with what you've been asking for months and years. You think never happens. I'm not testifying, but I can come close to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to sit, to look back and see things that come to pass at just the right moment to help you spiritually and physically. And you don't know where it came from. All we can do is thank God for it.
And it's really neat to, again, see what God is trying to accomplish in making us a holy people.
Yes.
You know, again, it includes, becoming holy includes my personal relationship with God, my ability to stand with Him before Him, but it's not just limited to that. Okay, we think about the, why should I be holy? Because it benefits me. Well, yeah, you need to be holy. You have to be holy. But more than that, it places you again into God's structure, God's building, God's house, God's temple, and it becomes something for the Gentiles to behold and can potentially cause them to glorify God when the time is right. And so again, it's not just about my personal salvation. It includes that. But God is involving me in something much greater than in saving me than just my salvation. Nick?
I would also, as we look at this, we look at the exhortation in the books of 1st and 2nd Peter, and it's drawing people back to letting them know who they are,
mm-hmm.
letting them know what they've been taught. Kind of going back to what I spoke about on Wednesday, we have to make sure that we, in addition, this is a message to them, that we are following the words that we're taught. We're doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because today, the world would, you know, they would say that, oh, it's okay, it's accepted these days.
Mm-hmm.
It's all right. That flies in the face of this saying, abstain, you're an alien, you're a stranger. Some translations use the word sojourner.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you're not of this group. Set yourself apart. And set yourself apart in such a manner as the life that you lead will give the honor and the glory to God. And the word visitation there can sometimes, some translations render it judge.
Mm-hmm.
So when God is the judge returns.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, be ready.
Mm-hmm. And as you think about, you know, again, as we progress through 1 Peter, again, what we are reading are some specific instructions to these chosen exiles on, again, their conduct. How do I look like a chosen exile? And so, again, that obviously applies for all of God's instructions. But, you know, we're going to be challenged at different times as we read through this to reflect upon ourselves and what our role is, what our responses are to different situations. I need to understand that God's instructions, whether I understand the plan or not, what God is trying to accomplish or not, I need to follow Him. And He's going to talk about ways in which we will impact our world because we follow God's instructions. And then they're in ways in which we may not have thought. All right, well, let's go ahead and continue. So if you have a folder, we'll now be going to 1 Peter 2, 13 through 25 lesson. And as we continue on, again, this is how to live in a world that you don't fit in. How to live as God's chosen people as exiles. And 1 Peter 2:12 tells us that we need to keep our behavior excellent. And from this point on, verses 13 to the end of chapter 4, Peter describes excellent behavior. He tells us what excellent behavior looks like. Here are some terms that we're going to read a lot of. The first term is submission. Submission is described in chapter 2:13, chapter 2:18, chapter 3, verse 1, and in chapter 3, verse 8, he says likewise, and that term likewise is connected to submission. He's going to tell them to do right in chapter 2, verse 14, in chapter 2, verse 20, chapter 3, 6, 3, 11, 3, 13, 3, 17, and in 4, 19, he's going to tell them to be holy again. So we got submission, do right, and then he's going to use phrases or expressions like the will of God or your purpose in 2:15, 2:21, 3:9, 3:17, 4:1, 4:2, and 4:19. And so, again, excellent behavior is going to be submissive, it's going to do right, and it's going to always seek God's will or God's purpose for my life. That is a summary of where we're going to be going in the coming weeks. Well, let's go ahead and read 1 Peter chapter 2. And Yolanda, if you'll read 13 through 17.
Submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as one in authority, or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men, and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as a bondslave of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king.
All right, so what's the first set of instructions for God's chosen people? What does their excellent behavior look like? What's the first word? Submit. What does this mean to submit?
Yeah.
Subject yourselves. You humble yourselves.
What's the military term? Rank.
Okay.
When you first enter the military, you're private person.
Bottom of the totem pole.
Bottom of the totem pole. And no matter what that general says, yes, sir. And that's what you seek to do. Anybody. And you see in our society, the police don't have the right to do that. Yes, they do. They're of higher rank in our society. Not that they're any better, but they have that authority.
You can maybe say the person is in and of himself, but the institution, the office, the work.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So submit. Submit to every human institution, whether to king, as the one in authority, or to governors as sent by him. Now you notice why. Do you see a why in verse 13? The first why, there's a few whys in this section. For whose sake do we do this?
For the Lord's sake.
Okay, that's kind of interesting. For the Lord's sake, we are to submit ourselves to every human institution. And so we are to have an inclination to obey every authority that is placed in society because of our reverence for the Lord. Now, do we understand this to be an unquestioning obedience to whatever a ruler might command? Is that what he's telling us to have? You know, certainly not. And how do you know?
Some things they say you can do, you can't do.
Yeah.
Spiritually or...
We must obey God rather than men, right? Our submission to the governing authorities is as a result of our submission to God, not ever in conflict of God's will. And so in whatever way those in authority ask me to do something, I am to submit or have an inclination to obey unless the ruler is calling upon me to disregard God's supreme lordship. Now, as you think about this, we do it for the Lord's sake. In your lifetime, have there been rulers or authorities that it was easier for you to feel inclined to submit than others? I'll just guess the answer to that question is yes. But regardless of how natural it feels for me to follow those placed in authority, I do it because of my devotion to God. And perhaps at the times where I feel it is the most difficult to be submissive to every human institution, perhaps in those challenging situations for me, I need to be willing to be faithful when it is hard or when I find it particularly difficult. Mark?
As we watch the media today, they find no greater joy in defining, well, a minister abused a child and did so 15 times. The world doesn't understand he is not of the Lord. And they rank all religions are the same. Therefore, it all affects God. And in a way, it does. But we, especially as children, Mom would whip me sometimes, my dad would, because you shamed my name. And that's why you're in trouble. You brought shame to my family, our family. So when we sin, especially publicly, and get caught and drugged before the media, we're bringing shame upon the Lord. That's why we don't do these things, besides it not being right, but it shames the Lord.
And again, if God is fitting us into this building to proclaim His excellencies, and our behavior is not becoming of those excellencies, then we've done a disservice to the very intention God has for us. What purpose does God have for authorities or governors, according to 1 Peter? I know there are other passages that talk about the roles of the government, so this isn't a comprehensive study. But what is God's intention for the authorities? Number one?
For the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right.
All right. So basically, to punish the wicked and reward those who do right. That's what governors and authorities are supposed to do. Do authorities always do this well? Yes, of course not. Turn back to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. As I think about, again, what I see often going on in our political world today, reminds me of Ecclesiastes chapter 5. You know, should we ever be surprised when people in authority do not use the power God has granted them in a manner that is consistent with what God has designed authorities and governors for? Ecclesiastes 5, starting in verse 8. If you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight. For one official watches over another official, and there are higher officials over them. After all, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. And so first of all, I want you to notice verse 8. He says, don't be shocked when you find officials not fulfilling the duty that they have in the province. Don't be shocked. Why? Because you got one official watching over another official. They're looking out for each other's interests. And then there's an official over him, which of course what's implied is there's a complex, you know, system of looking out for one another that often supersedes the responsibility that God has given them in their role. And so don't be shocked. But understand this, verse 9, having authorities is still an advantage, even when those authorities don't always use their role as God has designed them to. So, not really a part of 1 Peter, but I put it in our book, and just reminding ourselves of when you see corruption, in whatever form it takes, don't be surprised. But understand there is still a necessity to those structures.
We refer to that as a swamp nowadays.
Yeah, that's a term that's often used, a swamp. You know, verse 3. What is the will of God according to verse 15 of chapter 2? What is God's will?
the ignorance of the fool by doing right.
He has silenced the ignorance of the foolish by doing right. Now, you know, you kind of think about that phrase, the will of God. And when we read through Peter, you don't find the term will of God being used as people often use it today. People often talk about the will of God sort of about some expectation or desire they have for the future, or maybe some particular decision that they don't know which is the best decision to make, and so neither decision is evil or better than the others, and they might say, well, what is the will of God in this? That's a common way in which that expression is used. But in Peter, here's what the will of God is. You are in a situation where, it's not going to be easy to be in subjection to the ruler who is set over you. However, you need to do right anyway. It is God's will for you to do the right thing. Now, who is the ruler of, the audience that Peter is writing to at this time? Does anyone recall? I think we've mentioned it.
Nero.
Now, I want you to, think about this. Nero wasn't not just someone who had some corruption in his rule. He was one who violently persecuted Christians at times. He was one who was, he was insane. He was as evil and wicked of a ruler as there could be. And so what am I supposed to do as a citizen? And in a society where Nero is the king, I need to do right. It is God's will for my life. Now, if that is the case for God's people who are living in Cappadocia, Bithynia, Asia Minor, and so forth, to do right and be submissive to Nero, how much more is it for us to do the right thing, regardless of the current political majority in Washington, D.C.? We need, by God's will, to do right in any and every way we are able to and be the best citizen we can possibly be. And Yolanda already mentioned this, but what is the result of God's will being obeyed here? We silence the ignorance of foolish men. Now, in what way are they silenced?
We see with Daniel not bowing down before Nebuchadnezzar's idol he built. The change of heart of Nebuchadnezzar, yet once again, he silenced Nebuchadnezzar, the great king. Don't talk about Daniel's gods anymore. Daniel's gods are more powerful than mine.
That's a great illustration. Daniel stuck to his guns, and the result was foolish men had nothing to say. Yep. By doing good. That's right. Now again, if I'm already always cutting corners, and then I proclaim an allegiance to God, well, then all they have to do is say, well, look at you. You don't even pay your taxes. Right? You don't even, and the list can go on and on. Here, we are, when we fail to live submissively, it's like we are loading the ammunition in the gun of the foolish man to say, there is no legitimacy to Christianity. But when we do right, and when there is an obvious righteousness to our life, and again, doing right in every situation that we can, our testimony of good works becomes a defense, and people will see it. And so there is something greater accomplished when we do what is right in the context of a ruler who does not honor his position as God would have him honor. You can't effectively badmouth somebody who is doing everything right. And so God's will, do right, and that becomes a testimony of faith. We're going to go ahead and stop there. We will continue in that section Wednesday night. But as we're going to end every class, are there any particular takeaways that you would like to leave the class with this morning from 1 Peter chapter 2?
And just the importance of good behavior and submission. And I know sometimes people just have a natural tendency to buck against the law or to see a police officer and to think negatively of that individual, whereas we should be seen like that person is there as protection, as help, right? As someone who is here to do good. And that's how we really should see all the laws in place, right? Is they're for our own benefit, not to take away our quote unquote rights, but to help keep the peace and to punish evildoers and to reward that good behavior.
And we need that perspective. Any other takeaways? One takeaway that I'd like to leave us with is, remember, we are fighting a spiritual war. And I must be prepared to engage that conflict so that I do not find myself a casualty. And so what we are about from day to day and week to week is a great conflict. And I need to be aware of that. Any other thoughts? Stuart?
Speaking to that point of the war, it's easy to forget that you're fighting that war. Whenever you wake up in the morning, it's easy to jump into the tasks of the day and forget to take a second to remember what's most important, our spiritual warfare, our spiritual health, and not get carried away with all the physical necessities of life. The first stopping to remember the God that you serve, the purpose that you're here in the first place, and the mission that you have to accomplish in this war that we fight. Something difficult to do, something I struggle with, I know, waking up in the morning or remembering that. But just something to keep in mind.
Nick?
Yeah, it ties together Ecclesiastes 12 and 13 of fear God and keep his commandments with Acts 5:29 that we ought to obey God rather than man. We just need to stay on that pure course.
I visited a congregation once that actually had a sign as you're going up the building that said something to the effect of you're now entering the battle zone. And again, the idea again is this, we come here, we come together, and certainly we can talk about the battles that are sometimes found even among God's people, but here is our base. We come, we build each other up, we equip each other to go out and fight the battle. And maybe we need a sign on our front door at home, right? All right, well, we'll go ahead and pick up with question number 4 on the workbook next Bible class, which will be next Sunday morning, I believe.